Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wayne Madsen, a former security specialist with the National Security Agency and investigative reporter, who assesses the growing hostility between the Bush administration and Iran over that nation's nuclear program. Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who takes a critical look at President Bush's nomination of John Negroponte to become the nation's first director of national intelligence. And Shane Stevens of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, who examines the winners and losers of the U.S. Congress ratifies the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The February 12th murder of Sister Dorothy Strang, a Dayton, Ohio native who had worked in Brazil's Amazon rainforest for 30 years, shocked many forest protectors and focused new attention on the dangers of logging in the Amazon. Strang was well known as an advocate for the rainforest, its people, and a foe of massive logging in the Pará state in northeast Brazil. The 74-year-old nun was killed at point-blank range by two gunmen and had reportedly read passages of the Bible to her killers. Sister Strang is the most prominent rainforest activist killed in the Amazon since Chico Mendes was murdered in 1988 for organizing poor rubber tappers. The nun, part of the Order of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur, had recently met with Brazil's Human Rights Minister, Nilmario Miranda, to warn about new death threats that she had received. At the time, the Amazon was in an uproar over the suspension of logging permits. After a wave of protests by ranchers and loggers, the permits were reinstated. In response to Strang's murder and international condemnation, Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, sent 2,000 troops into the region to search for her killers. The government also quickly set aside an 8.2 million acre forest reserve and a million acre national park in the state of Pará to protect the Amazon from the ever-growing number of loggers. Miranda stated, "It is one thing to apprehend the perpetrators, but we may never know who ordered her murder." David Coor, a former high-level official in the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, is now questioning the Bush administration's commitment to its self-proclaimed compassionate conservative agenda. A former staffer to top conservatives like John Ashcroft and William Bennett, Coor had high hopes for Bush's faith-based program. As a candidate in 2000, Bush promised to pump $8 billion into social service agencies, including new tax incentives for charities and over $1.7 billion for faith-based groups aiding drug addicts, at-risk youth and teenage mothers. However, few of these initiatives ever got funded, as the Bush team instead pushed for big tax cuts for the wealthy, including the repeal of the estate tax. In total, programs for prisoners and at-risk youth received $500 million over 4 years, $6.3 billion less than promised by candidate Bush. In a column posted on BeliefNet.com, a religiously based website, Coor says the Bush White House made little effort to overcome political resistance in Congress to the faith-based initiative. Instead, Bush basked in the glow of the program's symbolism to appeal to the religious right. As Coor concludes, both political parties played to stereotype. Republicans were indifferent to the poor, and the Democrats were allergic to faith. Last fall, union hotel workers in San Francisco put a simple demand on the bargaining table. They wanted to negotiate contracts with the major hotels such as Hilton, Hyatt, and Starwood with a common expiration date. The hotel owners, represented by the multi-employer group, were seeking to increase worker healthcare costs and hated the idea of a unified contract. They not only rejected it in bargaining, but suspended talks until the union, Unite Here Local 2, withdrew their demand. According to the news magazine, In These Times, this led to an intense 5-week lockout by hotel managers. Local 2 countered by mobilizing a nationwide campaign against the hotel owners that led to one-day strikes in cities like Honolulu and Monterey, California. In Chicago, the Unite Here Local urged a local union boycott of hotels like the Intercontinental and the Four Seasons, owned by the same companies involved in the San Francisco dispute. The 4,300-member local also packed a public hearing of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to put pressure on the city to get involved in the lockout. Mayor Gavin Newsom tried to end the dispute but was rebuffed by the hotel owners. After 5 weeks of union pressure, the hotel agreed to reopen negotiations but with no agreement on the common expiration date. Local 2 did agree not to strike for 60 days but maintained its boycott of 14 hotels. Labour had shown the hotel managers it could not break the union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Since taking the oath of office for his second term, President Bush has made a series of blunt declarations warning that the U.S. will not tolerate Iran's development of nuclear weapons or support for terrorism. While the White House has given tepid support to negotiations conducted by European nations to reach an agreement with Iran, the administration is not ruling out military action. There's been speculation that either the U.S. or Israel might launch airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities if an agreement with Tehran cannot be reached. Former Marine Intelligence Officer and U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter asserted that, according to well-informed sources, plans had already been made for such an attack this June. Mr. Bush has also taken a hard line against the government of Syria, which has been charged with aiding insurgents fighting U.S. troops in neighboring Iraq. After the February 14th assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, the White House stepped up its campaign to isolate Damascus and to demand a withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon. Iran recently announced that it would support Syria against challenges and threats as the two nations deal with increased U.S. pressure. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wayne Mattson, a former communications security specialist with the National Security Agency, who is now an investigative reporter. Mattson discusses the possibility of U.S. military action against Iran and the likely effect on the ongoing American war in Iraq.
I wrote about an impending attack on Iran before the election. Now, obviously, there were other factors that Karl Rove had up his sleeve to ensure Bush's win, so they didn't have to go to Plan B, which would have been to try to rally national support for Bush during a quote-unquote time of war. But those plans were set to go, the fact that Scott Ritter's saying that it may be in June, they've just postponed it really for about, seven, eight months from what the original plans were. So that doesn't come as a great surprise. Back in October, of course, the USS John F. Kennedy was the center of the task force, which would have been involved in launching the airstrikes on the Iranian nuclear reactors. Kennedy, of course, is now out of the area, but obviously there would be another task force which would take part in such a military move, which I would think might very well involve Israeli military assets as well.
The neoconservatives in the White House believe that an airstrike against Iran could trigger a popular uprising against conservative clerics, the mullahs. What do you see as the likely scenario if the U.S. were to go ahead with an airstrike on Iran?
Well, it would have the opposite effect. Actually, although they're most of the Iranian population is under the age of 30, and they really have no recollection of the U.S. embassy hostage siege back in 1979, they're still Iranian. They're still proud to be Iranians, and I would say that in that case, the students and the moderates around President Khatami would rally against the United States and align themselves with the conservative clerics. So you would see an Iran pretty well united against the United States. Iran, like every other country in the world, the Iranian people, they may like Americans, but they certainly don't like the Bush administration.
What are the chances, in your view, of the European Union's efforts to negotiate a settlement that would essentially have Iran abandon its nuclear weapons research in favor of some other economic incentives from the U.S. And other developed nations?
Well, I think that's obviously the way to go. Iran has very strong economic links with the European Union, and they're not going to jeopardize those economic links by alienating the EU. So I would say that the Europeans have an awful lot of leverage over Iran, especially our ally in Iraq, the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, of course, is part of the three-party negotiation team with Iran, along with France and Germany. So the UK, of course, would not support, in my estimation, would not support any type of U.S. military strike on Iran. It would be very counterproductive to the UK, and we have to also remember it's the UK that has the majority of the troops in the southern part of Iraq, the area around Basra, where there's a heavy Shia population, and of course, the Iranian influence there is very, very strong, as we've seen in the results of the election, where the Shias, who were supported for years by Iran, did very well in the election results.
What would be the direct effect of a U.S. attack on Iran on the Shia population of Iraq, as you said, newly empowered through this election?
Well, I think it would inflame the Shias in Iraq. I think any notion that with the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who has been fairly supportive of the coalition efforts and the transitional government, I think that would all fall apart, and we would see, instead of a Sunni-only rebellion, I think we would see a coordinated Sunni and Shia rebellion against the United States, which would be devastating. Also, there would be repercussions in northern Iraq amongst the Kurds, because the Kurds have also received a lot of support from Iran over the years, especially the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, headed up by Mr. Talabani. They've received a lot of Iranian support, and I think Iran would hope that there would be assistance rendered back to Iran. I think that an attack on Iran would just be devastating in Iraq and result in a lot more American body bags coming back to Dover Air Force Base.
Given all these possible negative scenarios for the United States, do you think the Bush administration is still likely to go ahead with an airstrike if negotiations can't be completed with Iran?
Well, I mean, you have to look at the ascendancy of the neocons. Obviously, they are dominant. People say, well, Condoleezza Rice is a moderating influence. No, she was one of them. She lied for the neocons. She ostensibly is a neocon, and now she's running the State Department. You've got Porter Goss running the CIA. I would say that the neocons, the hawks, would prevail, and we may actually see them do something stupid like launch airstrikes on Iran, because these people, of course, miscalculated with Iraq. It was the neocons who suggested that our troops would be welcomed into Iraq with Iraqis throwing flowers and candy at them, and that there would be a statue of George Bush erected almost immediately in the central square of Baghdad. Well, obviously, that was just nonsense. They've been wrong before. They were wrong about Iraq, and they're going to be wrong about Iran.
That was Wayne Mattson, investigative journalist and former National Security Agency analyst. Read Mattson's articles online at www.onlinejournal.com. Making the last high-level appointment in his administration's second term, President Bush nominated career diplomat John Negroponte to become the nation's first director of national intelligence. Also nominated to the post of deputy intelligence director was Lieutenant General Michael Hayden, who now leads the National Security Agency. Both positions were created after Congress adopted recommendations made by the Independent Commission that investigated the failures of government leading up to the 9/11 attacks. If confirmed by the Senate, Negroponte will manage the budgets of 15 intelligence agencies, establish new standards among those agencies, and ensure that vital intelligence is shared. Negroponte worked with Henry Kissinger in the National Security Council during the Vietnam War and later served as U.S. Ambassador to Honduras, Mexico, and the Philippines. President Bush tapped Negroponte to serve as his ambassador to the U.N. and most recently as the first American ambassador to post-invasion Iraq. Negroponte's most controversial tenure was in Honduras, where from 1981 to 1985 he was a key player in coordinating the Reagan administration's clandestine and illegal attacks on the government of Nicaragua via the Contra Army. Negroponte stands accused of being complicit in or turning a blind eye to massive human rights abuses committed by Honduran military officials supported by the CIA. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who discusses Negroponte's past and why he feels it's important for the Senate to closely examine this nominee's attitude towards human rights that could further undermine America's moral authority.
There are really three strikes against Negroponte in his tenure, his very controversial tenure as ambassador to Honduras. First of all, he essentially served as proconsul. He was a throwback to the era of gunboat diplomacy when the United States attachés would essentially run these little countries in Central America. The first issue about him is that he was essentially managerially in charge of the Contra War in an extraordinary way for a diplomat. We have declassified documents, including memos to President Ronald Reagan, saying that Negroponte's ambassador was suggesting 3,000 new AK-47s for the leading Contra force, for example, and would the president approve of this recommendation? We have the declassified document with Ronald Reagan's two little initials RR in the yes box. That's just an extraordinary thing for an ambassador to be involved in, you know, micromanaging the amount of weapons going to a paramilitary force, attempting to overthrow a government with which the United States actually had still diplomatic relations. The second issue was that after the U.S. Congress decided, because of people like your listeners, that the Contra War should be shut down and cut all aid to the Contras in Honduras, Negroponte was part of a team of people that included Oliver North and others, and frankly, I should say, the father of the current President of the United States, who was then Vice President of first George Bush, participated with his team in circumventing congressional restrictions, the congressional cutoff on Contra aid, and Negroponte was instrumental in the bridge of communications between President Reagan and Vice President George Bush and the senior Honduran generals to bribe them, to offer them quid pro quos so that they would continue and even, in fact, actually step up their support for the Contra War, which was more needed than ever now that the CIA was supposed to get out of the picture and U.S. funding was no longer there. And of course, this kind of segment of the Contra War was funded illegally by funds from the sale of arms to Iran, then flowing and buying arms that then were illegally shipped to the Contras in Honduras. And the final issue that has haunted him, his career, and is the one that I think people are raising the most right now, is that he suppressed as ambassador full reporting of the atrocities that were being committed by the Honduran military, particularly its elite special operations unit called Battalion 316, which was working very closely with the CIA and which was clearly involved in death squad activity and in murdering suspected leftists, anybody who was thought to be supportive of Nicaragua or against the military government of Honduras. And even though the scale of human rights atrocities were lower in Honduras than in other countries that we were doing the same thing in, Guatemala, et cetera, but there were a number of murders there, and it became very controversial, and the human rights record of the Honduran military threatened to have Congress have more ammunition to cut off aid to Honduras. And so Negroponte's ambassador essentially appears to have told the CIA and the diplomats there, the attachés there, not to report on the atrocities of Battalion 316.
Well, why is it important in your view that John Negroponte be scrutinized closely for his conduct as ambassador in Honduras during these upcoming confirmation hearings for his new position as Director of National Intelligence?
There are several reasons. One is that Negroponte may well have misled the U.S. Congress in terms of his knowledge of human rights abuses in Honduras and the degree of which he had intelligence as ambassador on this and tried to distort that information getting back to Washington. And you don't want somebody in this most important role of intelligence czar who has a background of distorting the truth and misleading the Congress of the United States. Congress needs an honest broker to be the person that shares with it the information on our intelligence needs and the threats against the United States of America. Two, you don't want somebody who has a track record of turning his back on human rights abuses involved with a situation where we're already in a very controversial and dire strait with the atrocities that are going on, the torture of detainees in various secret detention camps around the world. You would want somebody who had some rectitude on that issue and could step forward and say, you know what, our intelligence needs are not served by this type of abuse, and it needs to end now. We're going to do it a different way. We're going to cease and desist of these immoral and reprehensible activities. Not only should a civilized country never engage in this, but they actually don't help us to learn what we need to know about the future threats to our country. And those are, you know, two reasons why he would not appear to be the best candidate for this position. I would have preferred to have seen somebody who had a long history of intelligence and knew the intelligence community. John Negroponte, as a lifelong ambassador, even one who participated very heavily in a paramilitary war against Nicaragua, was a consumer of intelligence. So he certainly knows the whole issue of how intelligence flows to the top, what quality it has. But in terms of managing these various intelligence bureaus, in terms of knowing the intricacies of how they work, he has not personally worked in any of them. And now he's being asked to coordinate all of them.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive. Contact the archive by calling area code 202-994-7000 or visit their website at www.nsarchive.org. The North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, went into effect on January 1, 1994. It eliminated trade barriers between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Over the past decade, tens of thousands of U.S. jobs have been lost, mostly to Mexico. As a result of the treaty, economists say local agriculture and the production of many industrial goods in both Mexico and Canada have been devastated. For the past few years, the Bush administration has been negotiating another regional trade treaty between six nations and the U.S., known as the Central American Free Trade Agreement. The accord has been approved by all governments involved, but has been ratified thus far only by one. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Shane Stevens of C-Space, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, one of the groups spearheading a week of actions to persuade the U.S. Congress to defeat the ratification of CAFTA. He discusses some of the pressure the U.S. has exerted on Central American nations in advance of ratification of the agreement and who stands to win and lose if it goes forward. Stevens also assesses how the outcome of the free trade agreement fight may affect negotiations for the larger free trade area of the Americas Treaty, covering every nation in the Western Hemisphere except for Cuba.
Six governments, the five governments of Central America and also the Dominican Republic, have all signed the agreement. But it still has to be ratified by their Congresses. And so far, it has only been ratified in El Salvador. In the Dominican Republic, the U.S. has pressured the government of the Dominican Republic to overturn a corn syrup tax that they placed on imports. And the U.S. said that, you know, this was in violation of CAFTA, so in order to pass this agreement, you have to overturn this law that your legislature has passed. And despite what that law was passed to do to protect local sugar producers, it's irrelevant because it goes against the dictates of CAFTA. In Guatemala, the same sort of thing also occurred, where the Guatemalan legislature passed a law allowing the production of cheap generic drugs, you know, from a lot of pressure within Guatemala to allow cheap drugs to provide for a poorer population, which is much of Guatemalan society. In the U.S., they claimed the same as they did in the Dominican Republic. They said that it goes against the essence of CAFTA, and you must overturn this law if you were to be included. Both of these countries, they've expressed their desire to overturn these domestic laws in order to be included in CAFTA. In Costa Rica, there were large sectors of society who were opposed to including things like telecommunications and other public services in CAFTA. Under CAFTA, they would require opening those industries to foreign investment. And, I mean, that's the real prize as far as the Bush administration is concerned.
There's a lot of groups that are opposed to CAFTA. Labor groups, human rights groups, solidarity groups like CISPIS, and others are opposed. Why?
The central reason why they're opposed is because CAFTA, like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, it basically exists as a bill of rights for corporate investment overseas. In every facet of the deal, it's clear what interests it's meant to serve. CAFTA isn't even about trade. It's about opening markets to foreign investment. It's about forcing every industry and service within a country to be placed up for sale to private corporations, and then also to construct a legal framework to protect investments by private corporations and also what they deem their right to profit.
Do all seven governments have to ratify CAFTA before it goes into effect?
It is a little unclear, but the way the opposition has been looking at it is that the CAFTA is, it's basically a series of bilateral agreements between the U.S. and each of these countries. So as long as the U.S. passes it, then whatever other countries pass it, it will exist between the U.S. and each of those countries.
This is a week of action to oppose CAFTA. What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, what we're trying to do is really focus on swing representatives, those representatives who maybe haven't stated which way they're going to vote on CAFTA, and really try to pressure them to make public statements against CAFTA. That strategy is really aimed at sending the message to the Bush administration that CAFTA doesn't have the votes to pass, and therefore the administration won't even bring it up. In many ways, that'll be the real measure of victory, whether or not the Bush administration even brings CAFTA to a vote.
CAFTA has already passed in the U.S. Senate. How do things look in the House?
It looks like there's 50 to 60 Republicans who are firmly against CAFTA. They need a two-thirds majority to pass CAFTA in the House. That requires 290 votes. So just to be safe, we've been saying that the opposition needs 90% of Democrats to oppose CAFTA. It is very doable. People are definitely looking at this as a real opportunity, and it looks like representatives are really lining up to oppose it.
CAFTA has been described as a building block to passing the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA. How do you see the connection?
The reason that the opposition is really seeing this as a struggle that we can win is because the previous attempt to pass the FTAA failed. The administration failed to meet the deadline of January 1st, 2005. And because of that, CAFTA, this smaller regional agreement, has been brought up, and it's meant to build support for the FTAA. And in many ways, if CAFTA fails to pass or isn't even brought up, then it could really be seen as putting the nail in the coffin of the FTAA.
That was Shane Stevens of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. For more information, call area code 212-465-8115. Visit the group's website at www.cispes.org or the Stop CAFTA Coalition site at www.stopcafta.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.